We're looking at the components of bratwurst and sausage and other protein-rich foods and what eating them could mean to our long-term health. It is the latest in nutritional science here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So if low-protein diets make mice healthier, why not us? A UW metabolism researcher has been grappling with that question, conducting experiments on what are called branched-chain amino acids, a group of three essential amino acids, or BCAAs. That acronym, by the way, could surface this hour. Do you limit the amount of beef or pork you eat? Are you vegetarian? What do you think it does for your overall health? Have you battled diabetes or obesity and changed your diet? 800-642-1234. Dudley Lamming is an associate professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Part of his research focuses on the regulation of metabolic health and aging by diet. Dudley, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
So eating less protein could make us healthier. What is your research pointing to? What did the study say?
Well, this is something that's sort of been emerging in both mouse and human health over the last couple of decades. And studies that have examined different levels of dietary protein in mice have shown that low protein diets are associated with improved ability to regulate blood sugar, in reduced adiposity, so the animals are leaner. And some of the animals live longer as well, as much as 30% longer, and they seem to be in good health while they do so. And epidemiological studies in humans have suggested that there may be some similar effects in people as well, with reduced rates of cancer, perhaps a decrease in mortality, and definitely positive effects on resisting diabetes. So people who eat more protein tend to have a higher risk of diabetes.
So you looked at these mice studies and said, I wonder what that would mean for humans. What have the human studies told you? Because you looked at men who were mostly overweight and had prostate cancer.
Yes, this was done with a collaborator, Luigi Fontana, who at the time was at the Washington University in St. Louis. And so with him, we looked at metabolic outcomes in men who are about in their 50s, a little bit overweight, and just for a short period of time, about 6 weeks. And so those people either stayed on their normal diet or they're randomized to eat a low protein diet. And we know exactly what those people ate because they're fed in the hospital cafeteria. And so over the course of the 6 weeks, the people on the protein restriction group lost weight. They lost about a pound and a half per week for 6 weeks. And a lot of that was fat mass. So this is, you know, not a lean mass loss per se. And their blood glucose levels went down as well, suggesting that it might have positive effects for people who are having trouble with diabetes or prediabetes. Now, the really interesting thing is that in all of these nutrition studies, we want to know how much the people are eating, because it's not interesting if people are eating less and lose weight. And so the protein restricted people actually ate more. Their calorie intake went up by about 10%. So they're eating more and losing weight.
They're eating more and they're losing weight. Can you go over what are protein rich foods and high protein foods so we can kind of get a sense of what we've been putting on our plates?
Sure. To take a little step back, we think of three major macronutrient groups, and these are the types of things that our body burns to make energy. Mm-hmm. And those are fat, carbohydrates, and protein. And of course, I think many of your listeners are well familiar with, for decades now, people have been saying you should eat different types of fats that are less bad for you. And more recently, that carbohydrates and eating too much sugar is bad for you. And so protein has sort of generally been thought to be neutral. And so meat is sort of our traditional protein-rich food. And basically all the meats are thought to be relatively high in protein, whereas plants and vegetables vary quite a bit more, but are generally thought to be lower in protein.
So, you know, your body needs protein to live. And if you don't give it adequate amounts, it will start to break down your muscles to get it. Is that a risk, losing muscle and hanging onto fat, if you really limit your protein intake?
So you bring up an important point. We absolutely need protein to live. And protein is composed of building blocks called amino acids that are sort of strung together hundreds at a time to make the proteins that we eat. And nine of there are about 20 amino acids we typically think about, and they're called the common amino acids. And nine of them are essential in the diet. And so this is true for mice and it's true for people. You have to have enough of these essential amino acids in order to live and grow and stay healthy. Our studies, we did a small clinical trial that's wrapping up now here in Madison, where we've been looking at people who, looking at the amount of calories and what people are eating, and trying to see if we can restrict branched chain amino acids in the people diets of these people. And generally speaking, it seems like most people eat about four times the RDA, the recommended daily allowance, of the branched chain amino acids, leucine, isoleucine, and valine. And these three BCAAs are the ones that, as you alluded to, have really become the focus of our research. But it seems like there's a lot of room to cut in the diet while still remaining healthy.
We're talking about new research on nutrition with Dudley Lamming from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in. Have you lost weight by following a new diet? What did you eat or not eat? How hard was it to follow the diet? And what do you eat in terms of protein in your diet? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dudley, you talk about the branched chain amino acids, or the BCAAs. Why did you zero in on these three amino acids?
So these amino acids have been known to be interesting for a long time. So as far back as 1969, it was shown that they're elevated in the blood of people who are obese. And since that time, particularly over the last 10 years or so, there's been a lot of effort to see if that applies more broadly. And indeed, but humans who are overweight or insulin resistant or diabetic or pre-diabetic, and rodents who are overweight or diabetic, they all have higher levels of these branched chain amino acids in their bloods. And then conversely, when people do things that make them lose weight, like have calorie restriction or gastric bypass surgery, or in our case, the humans that we looked at who we protein restricted, the branched amino acid levels in their blood go down. And so there's always been a sort of correlation between the healthier you are metabolically, the lower levels of branched amino acids you have. And so that's one of the reasons we started zeroing in on the set of amino acids.
Does the body need to have branched chain amino acids to survive? What role do they play?
They play a few different roles. So they're absolutely essential for protein synthesis. So any animal or person who doesn't have enough branched chain amino acids in the diet, doesn't meet their recommended daily allowance, is at very high risk of developing all sorts of diseases and conditions, sort of the amino acid equivalent of scurvy, where you don't get enough vitamin C. So bad things happen. This typically isn't much of a problem for people in our society because we're all eating quite a bit of protein all the time.
If you're just joining us, we're looking at what dietary amino acids have to do with our lifespan and our overall health with Dudley Lamming, an associate professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. His lab studies how amino acids could affect lifespan and metabolic health. Have you tried a number of different diets? Maybe it was vegetarian or Atkins or Mediterranean. Have you added or taken away protein-rich foods? What were the results? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dudley Lamming here on the Ideas Network. Why do low-protein foods make lab mice healthier, and what could it mean for our diets? We're looking for explanations with the latest on nutritional science here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW School of Medicine and Public Health metabolism scientist Dudley Lamming has looked into why diets high in three branched chain amino acids, or BCAAs, are associated with diabetes and obesity and other health problems. Did a health scare prompt you to change the way you eat? What changes did you make and did they help? Have your eating habits evolved in the pandemic? How so? 800-642-1234. Dudley Lamming is an associate professor in the Division of Endocrinology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health with us for the hour. Dudley, we heard from Laura in Belleville, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Laura is wondering about the difference between meat proteins versus vegetable proteins. And is one better and more healthy than the other?
Yeah, that's a really good question that a lot of people have asked. You know, there have been a large number of studies that have tried to look at people eating who eat different levels of protein and try and figure out if sources are important in this as well. And so I think the evidence is a little bit shaky, but certainly it suggests that if one of them is worse, then probably meat protein is worse for you. That said, there have been a number of studies that suggest that really it's about more about the amount of proteins, or in our case, branched amino acids, rather than the source. And so, I wouldn't necessarily advise anyone to, you know, give up meat protein per se. I think that both of them can be enjoyed as usual with these things in moderation.
Yeah, so it's really a quantity here and not so much where the source is coming from.
I think generally speaking, that's probably the safest answer.
Okay, let's go to Harry now in Madison. Harry, who spends a lot of time working out in the gym, I understand.
Well, yeah. So my question is, and you know, you read different publications and, you know, they really push, you know, protein in different forms. And I know a lot of young people are using like a protein shake, and, you know, I'm sure that's filled with probably some BCAAs as well as, you know, the kind of a, like a whey protein or something like that. It'd be interesting to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, so that's something that's really a very interesting question. And actually one of the things that we really want to start researching a bit more heavily now. So when you think about it, right, we think about the people, you know, in this country, in the United States, about 70% of people are overweight or obese. And so I would say, you know, all the studies that we do with rodents and most of the studies that we've done in people as well have been focused on people who are overweight or are suffering from obesity. And so I think that that population is quite different from the population who is, for the most part, consuming branched amino acid supplements, protein shakes, and so on, and then, you know, exercising and building muscle. So branched chain amino acids in particular have a good reputation in the exercise field because they're very enriched in skeletal muscle. So you need a lot of branched chain amino acids to build healthy skeletal muscle. And so my personal belief is that most likely people who are building lots of muscle and exercising and using those branched chain amino acids to build healthy tissue, that's probably good. Hmm. Whereas the most of us who are, you know, relatively sedentary and, you know, sitting down and talking on the radio all the time, for instance, or at our computers, you know, analyzing data, you know, aren't building and using those branched amino acids in the healthiest way possible. And so we have to get rid of those branched amino acids by breaking them down. And those, as we break them down, they turn into various things that essentially are energy that we have to get rid of. And so I think overall, that, you know, branched amino acid shakes or protein shakes for athletes are probably fine. Mm. This is actually something we want to study in our rodent systems, but you know, you can't necessarily find a rodent who is very interested in working out or, you know, swimming or doing all these other things that lots of people who take protein shakes do.
Well, amino acids, they're also the building blocks of antibodies, which help us fight off infections like upper respiratory infections. And is a very low protein diet concerning in that facet, especially now amid COVID?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. So definitely you need protein for a healthy immune system. But there's a little bit of a confounder, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we think about COVID, you know, age has certainly been shown to be the greatest risk factor, right? People mm-hmm. who are elderly are the most susceptible to COVID. And that's because their immune system is also aged, right? People who are older have an old immune system and it doesn't respond as well. So if you could do a protein restricted diet or a caloric restricted diet, which is another intervention that extends lifespan in mice, and you make the animal healthier and sort of younger, if you will, you know, would that counterbalance the effect? And so this I can sort of make an allusion here to osteoporosis. So if you take animals and calorie restrict them, they have thinner bones and frailer bones than normal mice, mice on a normal diet, when they're young. But when they get old, those animals who have been calorie restricted maintain that bone density throughout their life, whereas the mice on a normal diet, their bone density declines over time. And so if you started, you know, a protein restricted diet in the elderly, and we didn't talk about this, but the data overall suggests that your nutritional needs might differ younger in life and older in life. And maybe when you're older, you need more protein to help fight off, you know, muscle loss that happens to a lot of people who are older. So nutritional needs might change with age. And that's something else we really want to study. But if I had to guess, I would say that protein restriction younger is probably going to be more effective and better than protein restriction started late in life.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about nutrition and aging with Dudley Lamming from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And you can join in. Did a health crisis prompt you to change the way you eat? What changes did you make? And what do you think of a low-protein diet? Have your eating habits changed in COVID? 800-642-1234. Well, along the lines of losing muscle mass, Tom in Burlington has a question. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
I feel like the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz. She says, I'm melting away, I'm melting away. And as I get older, my muscle mass is melting away. And I've been taking these protein drinks to build up the muscle mass, but they also contain a lot of sugar, too. Mm. And there's also this aspect, they say that protein affects your kidneys or your liver adversely. I don't know about that. But I wonder if you can maybe address some of those problems.
Tom, thank you. Dudley.
Yeah, Tom, that's a very interesting point. So, you know, muscle loss with age happens to a lot of people. We might refer to it as sarcopenia, and it was recently classified as a disease for the first time, and something that people are putting a lot of effort into trying to think about ways to treat. And so one of the things that people try is, you know, high protein diets or high protein shakes and so on. But it seems like that the muscle, when you get older, isn't as good as extracting those amino acids from the blood and then using them to build skeletal muscle. So even if you supply a lot of protein, it doesn't necessarily get turned into muscle the same when you're old as it does when you're young. Certainly there are some other trade-offs too. People who are beginning to suffer from renal failure are also often advised to eat a low protein diet because getting rid of the nitrogen group in dietary protein requires the kidney. And so the more protein you eat, the harder your kidney has to work. And so if your kidney is starting to fail, then that's a bad thing. To someone who has healthy kidneys, that's usually not considered a problem. Same thing with dietary, with the liver, or you can imagine other tissues as well. You know, to some degree, that protein is necessary to keep those tissues healthy. But eventually, the liver and the kidneys both need to work to excrete protein that's not used. And so if you are beginning to have dysfunctions in those tissues and are forcing them to work harder, that could conceivably be a bad thing.
Tom, thanks for the call. Chris now in Racine, who participates in a diet study. Chris, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I was in the National Geographic study that developed the Blue Zone. And I and my family were a part of that study living in Loma Linda, which determined that Loma Linda was one of the longest lived places on Earth. And my dad is 99, and he can still shoot par golf. He didn't retire until he was 90. And I'm working full-time and very active, and I'm nearly 70 and haven't started slowing down yet. So, and we have, for generations, had a primarily vegetarian diet with protein, but we actually, mostly fruits and vegetables, and the protein will be beans, rice, legumes, and soy, and we're doing great.
Chris, thank you for bringing that perspective. Dudley, what do you make of what is on Chris's plate?
Well, I mean, it certainly sounds very healthy. And, you know, this idea that there are a number of blue zones around the world where people have both a lifestyle and diet that really promotes healthy aging is an idea that's very, very cool. And so, you know, does that diet sound healthy? I think most people would say that it sounds pretty healthy. One thing that my team has really been focused on is trying to think about how to design human diets that contain relatively low levels of branched amino acids, still nutritionally sufficient though, while keeping higher levels of other amino acids, because just eating a low protein diet in of itself seems to be beneficial. And so we definitely have looked at a lot of different types of foods. You know, off the top of my head, I remember that broccoli and almonds tend to be relatively low in branched chain amino acids, but high in protein overall. In terms of meats, you know, sort of turkey is probably one of the lowest common meats in terms of branched chain amino acid levels.
And we're going to pause right there with Dudley Lamming back after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're looking at protein in our diet and the implications on our overall health here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Beef and pork are among protein-rich foods with the highest levels of BCAAs, or branched chain amino acids. Turkey, almonds, some other types of squash have relatively low levels of these BCAAs. That's according to metabolism researcher Dudley Lamming, who's trying to understand what BCAAs do to us. Are you struggling with obesity or diabetes? Have you changed your diet? What questions do you have about protein that you love to eat? And what do you want to ask a nutritional scientist? Be part of this 800-642-1234. UW-Madison Associate Professor of Medicine Dudley Lamming is with us for the hour. So Dudley, you know, I often hear that when, you know, people notice when they're not getting enough protein that they just feel hungry all the time, that protein helps us, you know, feel full. How do you decrease protein intake and still feel full and satisfied?
Well, that's a really interesting question. So in our clinical study, the people who are on a low protein diet ate more, which is completely consistent with what you just said, as well as sort of this general idea that dietary protein helps us feel full. And when our animal studies, we see the same thing. Animals that are fed a low protein diet, they want to eat more, and they do eat more. You know, but despite that, they lose weight. Whether or not you know, that can be deployed to everybody, I think is a really interesting question. You know, one of the other things that we haven't talked about as well is whether a low protein diet would benefit everyone or just certain people. And so that's something else that we really need to find out as well.
Yeah. Have you made any inroads there? Because you also saw some differences between men and women, I understand.
We haven't seen differences between men and women, but have seen differences between male and female mice.
Gotcha.
And so we've looked at several different sexes and strains. So mice strains are essentially all clones of each other in one way. So it's sort of like looking, each time you look at a different strain, it's like looking at a different individual. We've also looked at some genetically heterogeneous mice that more model the genetically heterogeneous human population and in both sexes. And so what we've seen so far is that there definitely is a different response depending on your genetic background as well as your sex. And our longevity studies have shown that low protein diets extend the lifespan of males, but we haven't found that effect on females yet. So that's something, even though both sexes have improved metabolic health, improved body composition, and better blood sugar regulation. So there's definitely differences. And I think one of our long-term goals will be to try and figure out, you know, if, you know, we this idea of like personalized medicine and personalized nutrition, could we look at someone's genetics and sort of predict what type of diet would best help them have a healthy body weight and live a long time?
So does a low protein diet mean that you'll be eating more carbs or more fat?
So for our mice, we feed them more carbs. And that's a very interesting question, right? Because you think that carbs would probably be bad. But, you know, both in humans and in mice that where we're substituting carbs for dietary protein, we don't actually see that bad effect. And so I think there's definitely a lot for us to learn about the interplay between different dietary macronutrients and how protein and sugar play off against each other when determining ultimately the effect on our health.
Yeah, I would imagine it's such a tricky balance. And then you also have to look, you know, at your mice models versus humans that may not always match up.
One of the advantages potentially of changing branched chain amino acids specifically is that we, at least in our studies, we can keep everything else the same. So we can keep the levels of fat and carbohydrates identical and just modulate the levels of the dietary branched chain amino acids, but not change protein levels overall. And at least in that context, right, we wouldn't have to worry about consuming additional carbohydrates and what that might do to our health.
Have you personally tried a low protein diet?
I did try a little bit of a low protein diet. Well, it wasn't necessarily all that successful. I think, you know, many people have found that, you know, dietary interventions and changing your diet long term is difficult for everybody. And I think I'm no exception to that.
What was hard for you?
Well, you know, when we're thinking about all the delicious things that have lots of dietary protein, you know, I think everybody has their own list of, you know, foods that they would prefer to be able to eat. And, you know, denying yourself that requires sort of a long-term concentration of willpower.
What are some of those delicious things that are high in protein?
I mean, you know, some of the, I think we know probably where you're going to go. So the thing, food that we sort of identified in our records, our database search containing the most branched chain amino acids and also being very high in protein is bratwurst.
What about dairy? I don't know if I have to hug you by the.
I mean, I think dairy overall, you know, is a good and important component of a balanced diet. Obviously, it's rich in calcium, has all sorts of nutrients, and many people have shown that, you know, milk has various benefits. I also know that, you know, cheese is actually very quite a lot in their branched amino acid composition. And so while we haven't really made a exhaustive study of that, I think there's a pretty big range and one could concentrate on cheeses, for instance, that are lower in branched amino acids than others if you wanted to make those part of a healthy diet.
We're talking about diet research with Dudley Lamming from UW School of Medicine and Public Health as we look at these branched chain amino acids and what they do to health and diet. You can join in 800-642-1234. John is joining us from Gordon. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, I understand you have a diet that is very heavy into vegetables, not much meat.
Yes, ma'am. And I am a person who has a daily salad, a rather large daily salad, and I have romaine lettuce, avocado, tomato. I have a hard-boiled egg diced up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're throwing a lot in that salad, I would imagine.
I do, and considerable.
How have you felt since you've done that?
I felt wonderful, but I have lost considerable muscle weight. I do have chicken on occasion, and occasionally, very occasionally, a ground beef.
Okay. And so you're wondering whether you are getting enough protein.
Yes, and what might be a way of increasing my protein intake, good protein.
Dudley, your insights.
So the nutritional guidance from the National Institute of Medicine is actually very broad on dietary protein. And so they suggest that anywhere from 10% of your calories to 35% of your calories should come from dietary protein. In terms of what most people eat about 17% of their calories from protein. And our data, our overall data, as well as our very limited clinical trial data in humans, suggests that, you know, the low protein range is sort of engaged by probably about 7 to 9% protein. So, you know, I would say, you know, if that is all true in terms of, you know, being robust and, you know, going into humans, you know, I think that you could very safely, you know, increase your dietary protein levels by quite a bit. In terms of how to do that, you know, meats are very good in all sorts of dietary protein sources. And of course, there's, you know, many different alternatives. And of course, as was sort of alluded to, you know, dietary protein shakes also exist. Some of them also have a large amounts of sugar with them. But I mean, you know, it doesn't sound like necessarily that, you know, that you're eating too much protein right now. It seems like there might be a lot of room to go up. Although, of course, you know, we would think that, you know, a diet with so many leafy greens would probably be very healthy.
John, thank you. Let's go to Rhett from Crystal Falls, Michigan. Rhett, hi. Oh, and I think we just lost Rhett there. Or Rhett, are you with us? Nope. Rhett was going to say that they're allergic to wheat and to tomato and can't digest meat very well and gets most of their protein from quinoa and feels great. Are there any suggestions for someone who just doesn't do well with meat?
I think that, you know, it makes sense to think about other, you know, dietary protein sources. Certainly milk and cheese are very dense. There are some denser squashes as well, all sorts of, you know, vegetables. But that I don't think that that I could provide detailed dietary advice for Rhett.
You know, for decades, fat was seen as the culprit for just a host of medical problems like heart disease and obesity. And more recently, we've, as you mentioned before, have heard that carbs are the problem. Is it possible to really isolate one element of a diet and say, aha, that is the problem?
Well, this is an interesting question. So for mice, there's actually been a cool approach called nutritional geometry, where instead of just looking at a couple different diets, you look at a lot of diets. So you look at 20 or 30 diets at a time and use complicated mathematical techniques to sort of break apart these diets that are just varying in the ratios of macronutrients. And so these are some of the first studies, I think, that most people were willing to accept in mice, showing that low protein diets are really associated and very strongly, it's the protein with longevity and health. In those studies, fat didn't actually have a major role on lifespan, but of course, mice are not people.
We're looking at what dietary amino acids do for us with Dudley Lamming, an associate professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. His lab involved in studies about how amino acids could affect lifespan and metabolic health. Have you or a loved one developed type 2 diabetes? What dietary changes have you made to address it? Are you confused by all the new information about the healthiest way to eat? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dudley Lamming here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. When we eat protein, our muscles take the amino acids and use them to rebuild and repair. Athletes who don't eat enough protein, they're vulnerable to injuries. We're looking at what a low protein diet could mean for the rest of us, right? For people who aren't intense athletes, and how limiting several amino acids may lead to weight loss and longevity. We have Dudley Lamming from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, metabolism scientist, with us for about 9 more minutes. We heard from John in Milwaukee, called in, couldn't stay with us, Dudley. And John wonders, what are the best bean and grain combinations and whether you have any suggestions there?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I don't have any questions. I don't have any insights on bean and grain combinations, but I think that brings up an important thing that we could investigate as we sort of move towards looking at human diets.
Let's go to Ginny in Platteville. Ginny, good morning.
Hello. I was wondering which cheeses would be better, because you mentioned that there was a difference in cheeses.
Well, I think there We did look, only did a little bit of looking at this, but there is a very broad range in branched amino acid concentrations. But I think that that's also something that as we sort of develop more rigorous and test more rigorous diet recommendations for people, that that's an important thing that we can look at.
And your research also explored how these branched chain amino acids affect the aging processes. What have you found with longevity and lifespan?
Yeah, so when we start a branched chain amino acid restricted diet relatively early in life, we find that there's a significant extension of male lifespan. And surprisingly, given the important role of branched chain amino acids in muscles and building healthy muscles, the mice actually are less frail as they age. So normally, just like people, mice have increasing frailty as they get older. And that's blunted by these branched chain amino acid restricted diets. So not only are they living longer, but they seem to be living healthier lives as well.
So that is seems to be pretty promising there, that if you start early and you really start focusing on your health and diet early on, that could have long-lasting implications over the decades.
It's true. And, you know, I think that probably goes for a lot of interventions, too. And certainly, you know, the longer you can keep in good health, probably the more robust you will be as you age.
John now is joining us from Glendale. John, you're a vegetarian.
Yeah, I'm a vegetarian. I don't eat any meat. Well, that's a lie. Sometimes if I'm out at a restaurant, I'll order a salad with chicken, something like that. But basically, I don't eat any meat. I don't have any meat in my house. What I was wondering is I eat a lot of whey protein supplement, and it's very low in carbs. And I was wondering how that might work in a diet.
Mm. John, thank you. Dudley.
So I don't think that that overall, you know, in terms of whey protein is necessarily good or bad for you. I think that our research would say that, you know, whey protein it has a fairly typical amount of branched chain amino acids and, you know, that it's more of the overall impact of how many, how much protein and, of course, overall, how many calories one is consuming. So, you know, without sort of detailed you know, thoughts about the rest of your diet, I can't speak to that. But certainly it sounds like, you know, a vegetarian diet with whey protein from time to time sounds, you know, relatively good to me. And if it works for you, I think that's the most important thing.
And Dudley, you've been a vegetarian for how long?
I've been a vegetarian for about 15 years.
Yeah. How has that been going for you? Why did you become vegetarian?
I became vegetarian primarily. It's sort of an interesting question for a variety of reasons. But overall, I mean, it's been going quite well. But I definitely, you know, still consume dairy and eggs, and so those are, you know, very important. I think to being able to maintain that.
You know, we are regularly bombarded with studies about diet and what we should and shouldn't be eating. And it's, you know, all over the magazines and the checkout. How should the average person make sense of this evolving science, nutritional science?
Well, I think, you know, the most important thing in terms of thinking about diets is, you know, finding something that works for the individual, because I think that, you know, that's very important. And of course, you know, I think the other thing that's really important is, you know, one of the reasons that we're trying to use these amino acid restricted diets or BCAA restricted diets as ways of interrogating nutrition is eventually, hopefully, we'll be able to find you know, medications that might be able to help people achieve some of these same benefits without these hard to maintain dietary modifications.
I love how you use the words interrogating nutrition. Do you feel like it involves this really robust type of lab science in order to get to the bottom of what is and isn't good to take in, to eat?
I do. And I think it's a very complicated question, which I think explains why there's been so much confusion about, you know, what is healthy for you and what is not. There's so many different components to a diet, and how those all interact is a difficult problem. And I think that now we're starting to really dive down to a level where we can get good, robust information about what these dietary macronutrients and components do and how they interact with the individual's genes.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about nutrition science with Dudley Lamming from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health as we look and probe these amino acids. Dudley, why mice? Why are mice your go-to, you know, lab in carrying out this research? And do you use any other types of animals as you look at nutrition?
So mice are sort of the standard animal for many types of studies due to the fact that they are small. It's easy to study a lot of them at a time. Mm-hmm. And we can make all sorts of different genetic modifications to them as we need to. So we can investigate at a very molecular level the role of different nutrient pathways. The most important reason, though, is humans are very hard to do dietary studies on. You have to try and convince people to enroll in your studies, and then B, they need to be compliant with the studies and tell you accurately what they did. And that's been a very long-standing hard challenge, because even when people are trying their best to log at what food they are, there's always a lot of judgment. And, there was the nutrition person who was in a cubicle once upon a time, who was, whose job was just to call up people and say, was that a small pat of butter, a medium pat of butter, a large pat of butter? Yeah. And with mice, we don't have to ask those questions. We're feeding them, and we can measure exactly how much they ate.
Well, we're humans after all, right? I mean, on this whole compliance and accuracy thing. As we start to wrap up here, should people consider changing their diets based on your research?
Well, I think people should consider the possibility, particularly if they're not athletes and not trying to build lots of muscle, that perhaps they benefit from lower protein diets. But as I mentioned, I think the most important thing for anyone is whether their diet is successful at keeping them healthy and whether they can stick to it. So if someone is unhappy with the effect of their diet on health, then I think a low protein diet is something that they could consider and see how that works for them.
And what's the next step in your research?
Our next step in our research is literally doing genetic mapping on mice. So we're trying to find specific genes and alleles that explain why different animals and hopefully someday different humans respond differently to different diets. So that perhaps someday we can look at someone's genes from, a few drops of blood and figure out whether they would benefit from a low protein diet or maybe one of the many other diets, that people are looking at, be it vegetarian or keto or high protein diets, and figure out what the best diet is for each person.
Dudley, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dudley Lamming is an associate professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.